plunging ahead with the story of Samuel. We talked last week about Samuel, for all of his closeness to God and faithfulness to the truth and to his office and so forth, for all of that, had two sons who went astray. I could see Eli, who had, you know, fairly, I was going to say, not phony exactly, but his, it was obviously not a deeply sensitive priest, as we indicated by the way he handled Hannah, that there may have been some problems with his way of functioning with his young people, but I don't think that that would generally be true of Samuel, who was a very, very, very sensitive person, prophet or priest. He was a prophet, actually, not being in the line of the priesthood. But it really is a cause celebre, or rather a case in point, to speak to the issue of human relationships. It's not a side issue here so much. It has a bearing on human relationships in general. Of course, people already understand the course of true love never runs smooth. But it's more than that. It's the course of true friendship never runs smooth. Relating to other people always requires a lot of sensitivities that they're wanting, incidentally, in many, many people. Problems would be solved, resolved, I should not say solved, resolved. It's a different thing in a way. Solved means you've absolutely handled it. Resolved means you've come to some kind of armed truce, perhaps. Problems would be resolved a lot better if there was just plain old sensitivity to each other. But that kind of thing in embryo, or perhaps in similar ways, is true of many human relationships where people just simply don't think about each other. They're not sensitive to the other person's need. And you would think they would be sensitive, but they aren't. So problems emerge and develop that never get any attention because just one gets busy with one's work and life and activities and they just don't stop to think about what is taking place. So the course of friendship does not run smooth. It takes working at it. A good friendship requires effort. Any relationship requires effort on both parts. Some people are given to making that effort and some aren't. There's an old line that's been around for quite a while. Comes out in different, you'll pick it up in different situations, but it goes something like, you have to be a masochist to be your friend. That's true, you have to be almost a masochist to be some people's friend because others rip you up. It's germane to their nature that they... Some people just simply can't stand friendships, I guess, and people can rip one another up quite a bit. But all of this in the direction of saying that here is one of the outstanding prophets in all the Bible, whose relationship to his own sons was such that they, for some reason, went off the deep end and were a great heartache to him. There've been a lot of young people throughout the scriptural process or the scriptural history that were a deep problem to their parents. I think it says that about Esau. It says something very similar to the fact that he was a heartache to Isaac and Rebekah all their lives. He just was a young man that caused them heartache, grief, distress. You don't really expect to meet it in the elevated implications of the beginning of the human race, but there it was right there at the beginning of the human race. It just struck me at a point in time that the Bible makes a point of the fact that Esau was a heartache to Isaac and Rebekah all of their lives. This might have only a passing importance if it had only to do with, let's say, marriage relationships. It has to do with all human relationships. And the point we're really making here is not so much that you ought to be good parents, or that even not the point that parents don't always control the destiny of their children. The much, much broader point that life itself does not always run according to patterns. And people think, well, because I didn't follow the usual process here in handling my children, or handling a husband, handling a wife, there's something wrong. It isn't that so much as it is that human beings, in order to maintain good relationships, need almost to be superhuman beings. You know, to maintain a good, smooth relationship, you have to be a caring, open, unselfish person. I doubt if any friendship can really survive too much selfishness on the part of either one. And many times marriages settle into caretaker relationships. As I've had to tell people over and over again, be sure that you are doing what Christ wants you to do. You're the kind of person he wants you to be. And let the other side of it take care of itself. I wouldn't even discuss with people the putting together of a marriage apart from the primary point of saying, you know, who are you, first of all. You can't always control what the other person is going to do, but you can control what you do and how you relate to the marriage. And if people come together, come to me, for example, just to have a happy marriage, that's not my job to give them happiness. If they come to say, how can I get myself into the right frame of reference, right attitude, what about me? Not what about them, but what about me? That's usually a pretty good starting point for correction. You can be what you ought to be as a person, a human being, sensitive, open, caring. The other person will have to come to grips with whoever they are. But in cases where the entire marriage term becomes centered in keeping one person happy, it's going to be disastrous. Where a whole marriage centers around keeping the husband happy. Everybody has to bend so that he's happy. I've been in many situations like that, but one in particular where the husband expressly said to the family, if I'm happy, you'll be happy, you know. Very openly said, stated. It's a childish, dumb way to function as a man of the house. It's dumb. And I've often said to the young men that the man of the house has got to function in the same way that a person functions in a business. The employees are the ones that get the attention. The owner of the business goes home last at night and doesn't take the money first. In other words, he gets his money when the rest of them have been paid, goes home when the work is done, not when the clock strikes. And a lot of things about entering into a business, but are disadvantageous if a person is interested in just simply personal welfare, that you never go into business, because the welfare of the employees always comes before the welfare of the owner, theoretically, if you want to stay in business. By the same token, in a marriage, the man of the house, the husband, has a job to do. He may hope for many benefits and blessings and so forth, but fundamentally he's got a job to do. Whether he's happy or not is secondary. The family is taken care of, supported, ministered to, is fundamental. On the other hand, you have a common problem among wives, where before marriage, of course, the young fellow is just so totally given to the girl that he can't stay away from her, and he showers her with gifts and sweet sayings and so forth. Then they get married, sometimes a different thing, but the girl by now is used to being pampered and petted and so forth, and every whim satisfied. all of a sudden, everything in the home may revolve around her. So she becomes the focal point, and every activity in the household outside of the work hours is focused on her wants, her needs, her desires, and so forth. Well, it's not an uncommon problem. But once again, I'm saying where the entire home revolves around one or the other, the wife or the husband. And the husband may be just completely out of the picture while he's fighting desperately to keep her happy, but it can be the other way around. You know, everybody's just walking on eggs and tiptoeing around and being so careful not to say just the wrong thing or do just the wrong thing, and every whim of the other person is trying to satisfy and so forth. Well, that's just a bad relationship. It's not going to work over a period of time. Couples may stay together, but it's going to be more of an armed truce than anything else. Someone was asking me if I thought that there were many happy marriages, and I think a very few happy marriages. There are a lot of satisfying marriages. There are maybe not so many satisfying marriages that we like to have, but there are a large number of marriages that are just holding on to staying together because selfishness has just been such a big problem in the marriage on both sides. This has no place in marriage. A person has a great, what should I say, desire for personal independence or freedom, they probably better not get married. But once you get married, there's got to be the setting aside of all personal considerations as far as guarantees. But that's also true of parents. Parents that relate to children on a quid pro quo basis, that is to say, if you kids will be good to me, I'll take care of you, I'll be good to you, you know. The young person expects the parent to hold together. And anybody who's been in the teaching profession, anybody who's had a lot of dealing with young people understand the simple principle. They will push and push and push as hard as they can to get their way, but they're hoping against hope the adult will not cave in. They hope you won't exceed. They would like you to exceed. For example, in a classroom situation, if you have young people that are coming up to a point of whether or not to have a test or, you know, any number of things that they might have demands on, and sometimes the demands are a little out of order, and the test has got to go on, but they're pushing not to have it. They'll push on the teacher and push on the teacher. They don't want the teacher to turn them down. On the other hand, they're hoping against, they really hope against their desires that the teacher will remain strong as an overall image. But the same is more deeply true where it comes to the relationship between parents and young people, where the young person can kind of storm around and fuss and fume, but they hope the parent won't cave in. They can cave in emotionally, but they hope the parent won't. And the very worst thing any parent can ever do is to join them in their emotional insecurities. A parent then has to pretty well forget about their own emotional satisfaction. They may have it or they may not. The emotions of human beings are on a roller coaster. They're up and down and up and down. There's no way to really pin it down. I've always advised young people to ride about an inch above the roller coaster in their relationship. You know, just let the tirades come and go, but don't be swept into it, because these emotional outbursts are irrational. Obviously, from the beginning, they're irrational, aberrational. People don't even know why they do the things they do, or why they say the things they say. Young people have often said that to me. They've had some outburst with parents, and they don't even know why they would say the things they did, or do the things they did. Say, why have I been stubborn in this situation? Why have I ignored the situation? You don't even know. So the course of human relationships does not run smooth. But the only really key to sound human relationships is the sense of personal interaction with Christ, where we're going to be whatever we have to be and do whatever we have to do for Christ's sake, in spite of what the other person does or does not do. Especially in dealing with young people, if you build your relationship with a young person on a quid pro quo basis, that is, if they're going to treat you this way, you're going to treat them that way. You say, And that, of course, is in all relationships. You know, all right, the all right for you attitude, in quotes. All right for you, that's a disaster to relationships. So you have to be steady yourself, whether the other person is steady or not. If each person in a married relationship or a parent relationship, especially if the parent, would take the attitude that I'm not here to so much build happiness as I am to build strong relationships, you'd come out a lot better. The husband must take the more a shepherding attitude of being strong enough for the whole household to forget his own demands and needs. I don't mean he doesn't have a right to them. I don't mean that a family ought to forget his needs, but I think he has to make his own personal needs completely secondary. Then he may have a fighting chance of building a pretty decent relationship. The focus is, how can we have substantial homes? How can we please Christ? How can we honor Him in our home? The other will take care of itself, but where the focus is, here I am, make me happy. And the counselor and the books all serve that end. You ought to make your mate happy, or your mate ought to make you happy. You hear these things over television, radio, read them in books and so forth, where the whole focus is, my husband is not making me happy, what shall I do? Well, here's what your husband should do to make you happy. That's especially unfortunate in interview situations or call-in programs where someone says, my husband does this and this and this, or my wife does this and this. And any counselor worthy of the name would be very foolish to respond to that one-sided statement. It's a dangerous situation. In fact, I cannot imagine the brazenness of some who undertake to give counseling over the telephone. That goes for secular and non-secular as well. And in a sense, you get it in the Dear Abby kind of thing. Somebody writes in and says, here's my problem, and Abby writes back, well, here's at least, she's maybe as good as any, but she writes back, and here's the solution. So the person cuts it out. See, hubby, see what Abigail says? Well, you know, maybe Abigail didn't have all the facts. And it's extremely perilous, because there are always ingredients, there are ingredients on both sides. And sometimes it's one-sided, but you have to know the whole situation before you can really give any significant advice. Even then, it's it's questionable whether you can give advice at all, unless you can get completely inside the person. History of psychology has gone through its phases, and of course the most lasting and deep phase was the Freudian phase, where everybody was a Freudian psychologist. In fact, I was talking to Dr. Plagans up at Camarillo, who is the superintendent of the hospital at the time that I was working up there with different ones. And we had some good conversations, and he used to say to me that every time he saw me come in the hospital, he wanted to put his arms around me, because he appreciated somebody would come in there and work with these people. So we had a good enough relationship, but he was pretty honest about his comments. And, you know, we talked about what the prevailing mood of the psychiatrists of the hospital were at the time, what the prevailing mood was among them. And he said that probably 95% of them were Freudian psychologists. Well, that was, of course, the prevailing trend in the I'd say, you have to say 40s, 50s, 60s, was a prevailing mood or move among psychologists. And yet, today, the whole Freudian thing has been pretty well discounted. I don't think anybody today would really admit to being a totally Freudian psychologist. One of the problems, of course, was the time factor. It'd take you 2 or 3 years of weekly visits, pretty expensive, time-consuming, but that wasn't the chief thing. Lately, things have come out. Articles have been written where a lot of things have shown up that indicate that Freud himself didn't believe some of these things that they're identifying with Freudian psychology, or that he was unwilling to really express his own true beliefs, but pumped this thing. Anyway, it's been pretty well discredited, but yet here are people whose whole marriages depended upon that approach to psychology. And almost any kind of secular approach, any kind of psychotherapy that is based upon a particular school of thought, you see, you say, well, we're a behaviorist or we're gestalt or whatever, and people put their marriages on the line to get counsel from psychologists who are pushing a particular fad at that time, and of course the ministers tragically just follow along like little puppy dog. If they go to the American Psychological Association, they certainly wouldn't want to be considered not a psychologist of the state of the art, if we can say it that, whether it would be now behaviorist or Freudian or whatever, you see. And so they try to be psychologists in the best tradition of current psychology. And it's caused a lot of disruption in marriages. As I said to a person today, even, I said, look, it's not possible for me to really determine who said what and who did what. People can come to me and say, well, he said this and she said that and he did this and he did that. I don't know. I have no way to really know. It really boils down to a point of each person in the relationship. And this, again, if you're anybody here is single, I guess not. But it boils down, oh yes, there's one left. It goes for all human relationships anyway. It's not just marriage, it goes for all human relationships. That the only ultimate solution to sound human relationships is that each person within the relationship is most concerned not about how can they make me happy, how can that person satisfy my emotional need. Question is, how can I function as a sound human being, as a member of the body of Christ? And of course, we obviously understand that we're not going to fulfill all the demands even then. If you say to yourself, I am fundamentally responsible for my relationship. You say that. But you can, because in a sense, how you react to a situation will pretty well determine its ultimate solution. If you react selfishly, or you react irately, or you react in unsound ways, it's only going to worsen the situation. And the old attitude, how dare you say that to me, type of thing. Whereas if you can manage to see human beings as all more or less imperfect, this is always that you have to be patient with people. And you let them say things. You have to let people say things that can be unguarded without holding them ultimately responsible for it. When I say ultimately responsible, of course, I mean that there's a limit to how much you ought to dote upon or focus upon a given statement that might have been made in an offhanded moment, or even a given action that might be offhanded thing where you just do it and you don't really know why you did it that way, but that's the way you did it. And you have to let those kinds of things float in the whole milieu. Human relationships, there's a lot that you have to let float. You see what I mean? Not tie it down and say, aha, that's the way this person is. That may not be the way that person is. Maybe just the way that person was under a given set of circumstances at a given moment. But there needs to be a lot of patience. Now, that does not excuse people from treating you poorly. It doesn't excuse husbands or wives from treating you poorly. But it helps a lot to recognize that in human beings there is this innate inadequacy that does not always respond magnificently to every situation. And some days will respond worse than other days. Depends on your physical state, what you had for breakfast, what has happened in your life that day, what other people have done to you. So many things that affect this relationship that if we can be more or less generous and let incidents float as incidents rather than docking them to the pier of analysis. You see what I'm saying? It's all right for you. That's the way you, if that's the kind of person you are, you know, that kind of response. If we can do that, the relationship will tend to keep itself afloat. Because, you know, often I have discovered that very often people will do something in the spur of the moment or say something on the spur of the moment, and later they themselves know that wasn't sound. It wasn't a right thing to do or a right thing to say, and they know that. Sometimes the situation is such it'd be very difficult to try to bring it out and deal with it. Usually the best thing is to say, look, I don't know why it happened that way. I'm sorry. Now, it involves the other person receiving that, too. Not holding you to it, you know, in a sense. You say, look, I don't know why I did it that way, but I did, and I'm sorry. Maybe, for example, this is just really a casual kind of thing, but let us assume now that a young fellow is, the wife is waiting dinner. There's a lot of young fellows here that are married now, and they've got wives. And the guy stops to talk to a buddy or something, and the conversation goes too long, and suddenly he realizes the time, and he heads for home, but he's late. Now, what is she going to accept from him as an apology? That's the question. And he says to her, well, I'm sorry, I just got involved with this conversation. You knew I was waiting. You knew dinner was at whatever. And, you know, why would you stop and talk to him? Is he more important than I am? You see how these things can escalate, you know? How often that kind of thing happens? Or the wife goes off shopping? The women like to shop. And, you may think your wife is the only one that likes to shop. But they all like to shop. And money or no money makes a little difference. And so, you know, they're gone. They're gone over the time. You knew you were supposed to be here at 2 o'clock, and here it is 2:30 or whatever. I've been worried about you. Where you been? Well, I just got busy shopping. Well, you know, is that a good enough excuse? Well, depends on what your flexibility is. And all of these matters, things people buy, for example, a husband or a wife will make some impulsive purchase. Can't understand why you were such an insane fool to make such a purchase. They can't understand it. You knew we couldn't afford that. It's a very common problem. What do you receive as an explanation? What are you willing to receive? The person says, well, I know I shouldn't have done it, but the salesman talked me into it. Well, what should you do with that? Let it float like a raft. Don't make an analysis and say, aha, you're a weak person, or why do you let salesmen talk you into things, or you've always been that way. None of that stuff. Let it float. They can't really explain why they did it either. Now, let us say you are on the other end of the situation. You're the one offended. Let's say the wife goes out and buys something that she shouldn't, or the husband, or does something she shouldn't, or says something he shouldn't say. And you're the recipient of that offense. Now, you see, you have the power to make the situation better or worse by what you're willing to receive of that person and their explanation. What you're willing to accept as their personality, aberrations or these quirks that happen all the time. And I've talked to some of you about these things, but here's, for example, your grid pattern. If you were to see a scan, a graphic scan of the brain, you'd find these squares, grid pattern. I've used that, although it's certainly crass. I mean, it's not technologically exact the way I use it, but let's say we have our grid pattern and you have these squares, these graph patterns, and you have people that have a little skew in one of those areas of the pattern, more or less depending on the nature of the trauma. Well, as long as they keep away from that, everything flows nicely, and then they hit that little skew and things can go in any direction. And those are the bases for decisions we make that are impulsive. And we have to understand in each other impulsive moods and decisions, where someone can say to you, well,
I really lost track of the time. I'm sorry. I let it go with that. Okay. You lost track of time. I acted impulsively. I shouldn't have bought that. Well, you know, we can't afford it. Okay. I shouldn't have done it. Yes, that's true. But let's let it float. Your brain is kind of like a tape that can be put together in uncertain patterns. Like someone taking a tape and splicing it to bring about a different end to a conversation than was originally intended. And our brain works that way sometimes. You know how it happens in dreams. That's why I've never felt that dreams were a significant basis of analysis. Because these bits of tape get put together in bizarre relationships that may or may not mean anything. So if one has recurrent nightmares, there's probably some fundamental underlying cause. But I'm talking about your casual dream things where you find yourself in various kinds of situations. But that's how we behave. That's how we think. That's how we act. And we do things without thinking. We say things without thinking. Parents say things to children without thinking out what the implication of that statement is. I've always called it shooting from the lip. They don't understand what, they don't stop to think of the implications of what they're saying. And so, as I've said before, I've been in situations where I've had to arbitrate with parents and children where the parents have already taken everything away from them they could possibly take away, and now they have no more room left. They've taken away the family sedan and the television and the rock and roll records and grounded them for a month. The point I'm making then, of course, is that parents will say things to young people that are not really well thought out. There are times when a parent simply has to go back to the young person and eat it. Wait a minute, I really wasn't very smart, and it wasn't really the thing to do. I think we'll change it. Don't be afraid to do that, to change your thinking about something. It may seem to you that you're backing down, but don't be afraid to back down if it's wise to back down. Because if you think it's backing down can be, in the mind of the young people, just a stubborn thing, too. They think you're just being a fool because you're not going to back down. They know you should. So the thing is true with wives and husbands, friends. All human relationships come under the same general pattern. People do things and say things impulsively, can't really give you a basic reason why they did it or why they said it. And from the other end, the receiving end of those things, those aberrational behavior patterns, you have to see it in the light that you would want them to see you. You let people have the right to impulsive words and behavior without demanding an analysis of a rigid nature. If you can't understand the other person's action, they probably can't understand your actions. And only God can understand all of us in our actions, our behaviors, and our attitudes, and so forth. I'd say normally we are slightly off in our evaluation of the other person. We think they mean one thing, and they don't really mean that. Maybe they seem that they mean that, but they don't. That's true of people that we think, maybe people you think don't like us, a common problem. Well, if they really appreciated me, why would they say that kind of thing? Well, they don't even know why they say that kind of thing. But normally our evaluation of people is just slightly off, just enough off to make a fuzzy relationship with others. Still, we're not off the track. We're going back to the point of Samuel, who was one of the great prophets of the Bible, whose sons were out of line. Radically out of line. How does God have to relate to us in our misbehavior, our misadventure? That is, in terms of our reaction to Him and to one another, reactions to God Himself may often be impulsive and unthinking. You may accuse God of things, charge Him with things. It's like Job. In Job's case, he was battered pretty heavily, and yet in God's analysis of Job, He said of him, in all of this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. See, here he was the recipient of much distress in his life, and he could have charged God foolishly. You see, he said, all right, God, you, you've had it now, because I know now you're really against me and all that kind of stuff, which people are inclined to say, but I think God has to accept even our impulsive statements and our own remonstrances, we might say, where we react to God negatively. Why did you allow this to happen? You must not care. I presume almost every individual at one time in their life or another has made radical statements to God. But we hope, all of us, hope, as young people hope for us, we hope God will not cave in. We hope He'll recognize that we're speaking impulsively and not hold us to it. So we should receive the same. We should see our young people in the same way. That, yes, they've spoken impulsively, hatefully, disparagingly, whatever. And yet we have to, not to let them become used to, you know, what we call sassing or talking back or whatever. I don't think parents ought to let young people be disrespectful. That's a different thing. But I'm talking about receiving their aberration behavior or that impulsive statement where a young person is normally pretty responsive. I mean, they recognize your authority and they do respect you and so forth, but come out with some kind of impulsive statement that may be disrespectful, and you can well advise to remind them of it. They look that's a little disrespectful, but some parents react wildly and whack them across the mouth or something, which only breeds resentment anyway. So there is this two-way pattern of being tolerant of others, as we hope they'll be tolerant of us, and being tolerant of God.